Today is Thursday, October 20th, 2022. This is part 7 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N-M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm fine. It's kind of chilly here in Alabama, believe it or not. 28 degrees yesterday.
Oh, my.
So we're not playing around with it. Real cold. But it's going to be nice, sunny later on, a warmer day. So
oh, good.
It's all fine.
Oh,
it's
good. I don't think of Alabama as being a place that ever freezes or snows or anything like that. But
oh, yeah. It doesn't snow much, but it sure freezes.
Okay.
At least in the northern part where we are.
Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the phone?
Yes.
Thank you. One of the things you'd mentioned that kind of got me wondering about the interview last time was the small visitors contact station that you had, and it kind of made me think to ask you about the electrical system and the phone system and some of the other operational systems of Pipe Springs National Monument. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Yes, especially the phones, because the younger generations don't have a clue to what we dealt with then, because there was one phone line that came from Kanab, Utah to Fredonia and out to Moccasin, which was the little village 5 miles up the road from Pipe Springs. There was a spur line that went over to Pipe Springs, but it was a party line.
Okay.
And there were 8 parties on the line, line. So when anyone called, any of the above people, anyone living at Moccasin or at Pipe Springs, it rang on all the phones, and there was a code that the ring would come through on. The operator, it was physically a lady up in Kanab that would, got the phone call coming, and the person told who they wanted to talk to, and then she would give the rings by this code. There'd be like 2 long rings and 2 long rings, or 3 shorts and 2 longs. And anytime the phone rang, everybody picked up. And the operator would ask for the person that was getting the call, and if they were on the line, then of course she'd hook it up. And in theory, everyone else would hang up, and you'd hear, if you were getting the phone call, you would hear all these click, 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 clicks as everyone else who was home hung up the phone. That was the polite thing to do. I don't think there was much listening in, except that everybody up in Moccasin was family, and sometimes, they would get a call, and one of their neighbor's relatives would say, let me talk to her when you're done, sort of thing.
Oh, my.
It would be aunt so-and-so or grandma or
right
kid or something. But it was a very strange situation. But people didn't call a lot in those days, and especially out to Moccasin. But it was a great modern thing to have this system. And I know there was it was one of the 8 lines, so-called, went to Pipe Springs, And they, it rang in the office in the Gerdes house, my house, and the maintenance guy's house. So four people potentially picked up if the code came through for our line. And, you know, like I say, it worked, but it was definitely different. And when we moved into Fredonia in later years, we had just a regular landline phone. But
I would imagine that worked both ways for incoming calls, but for outgoing calls, you'd have to pick up the phone and see if you heard voices.
Exactly.
And you might just want to listen in when you picked it up. Say, who am I listening to? What are they talking about?
Yeah, well, that was possible, but most of the time, if you picked up the phone and saw that the line was busy, you hung up kind of, you know, didn't bang down the phone, but at least I preferred to, you know, put down the phone so that everyone knew that I wasn't listening. But that was just my thing. I don't think many people listened to much. They didn't have time. Everybody was busy.
Okay. And when do you think that changed? When did they finally get their own lines into the monument?
I had never thought of that. And it could have been, you know, several years later.
Okay.
It just, out there was, it was isolated, and they got kind of the last of the new facilities. So
I
hadn't thought of that really, because we moved to Fredonia, where my wife taught school, so we had regular phones.
How did the
other thing?
Yep, go ahead.
Oh, what was your question?
No, go ahead.
Okay, I was just going to switch to the power.
Oh, please.
Because they did put in a regular power poles and power system along with when they paved the highway, and to Moccasin and the Indian Village and the Five Springs all, you know, had regular power, but it was kind of unpredictable, and especially in a thunderstorm and lightning striking there, you'd assume that you'd lose power, and I remember one situation that was kind of funny, and it shows the case, because there was a storm afternoon, early morning, or early evening, and the power went off, and I could see, well, in my house, I, you know, had all the camping gear there, so I'd light up a Coleman lantern and have in the kitchen, dining room, or out in the living room when I was just sitting, reading, or doing whatever work I was in the evening. And I think that Gerdes did the same. And I noticed that the power lineman came along checking pole by pole to find out where the power, where the outage had taken place, and he went up the highway, and then quite a while later he came back, and he was looking at poles, and he finally drove around to my place, which was first in line as you went into the housing there, and I asked me, you know, he said, "I'm trying to restore power out here, but it just doesn't make sense to me because you guys have got power and no one else does." And from the road, you know, they're a quarter mile away, he looked over and our houses were all lit up. Well, by coming up to my door, he he had to laugh and tell me what was going on, because, now that I know you haven't got power, I know where to go now.
Ah.
And later on, he did find it, but, you know, they it was a little harder in those times, too, but that was a funny event that I remember really well.
Before the electricity came in, when the road was paved and realigned, did you guys have your own little power plant?
No, they didn't. As far as I know, the power was brought in quite early from Fredonia to Moccasin and Pipe Springs. There were just little poles that kind of went across the desert there. And when I arrived, there was a, what if we'd call a modern big power pole next to the highway there, and they're still there.
Okay, got it.
I'm not sure when. Before that, there was just no power at all out there. Everybody grew up with lanterns and some candles, I guess. Traditionally, everybody went to bed at dark and got up at dawn.
Right, right, and had candles and
yeah.
Kerosene lamps.
Yep. That wasn't so far away from when I got there in the 60s. They had that.
Okay, all right. You had mentioned your relationship with Mary Beth Riffey, doing bird surveys in the early mornings, go up and do the quarter mile by quarter mile survey along the ponds and the orchard area. Can you tell me more about the Riffeys?
Yeah, quite a bit, because I had met him early on, probably the first. This time when I, you know, came to northern Arizona and started hiking and ended up never leaving, one of the first stops was driving to the monument to Toro Weep, and I met him there. I think people had told me that he's really special, and I did, and, you know, he just greeted me like a long-lost friend, and I spent a lot of time listening to me and where I had been, what I had been doing, what I was going to do, and he was, you know, quite enthused, and I made, dozen trips out there, going to hiking that whole western side of the canyon, and always kind of putting my ideas and plans to him. And he never really told me, don't go there. It was, explaining what happened, what I was getting in for. And in the end, if you had asked, I probably would have said he was my main mentor for this whole year out there and for this whole direction that I took. I just such a good person and involved me in everything I wanted to be in and helped me out a lot. And I'll mention a couple things because most of the time he was living there by himself. It was quite a couple months until I met Mary Beth, and then she came out and set me up for the bird survey. But most of the time he was there, and he was interested in the fact that I wanted to hike all the old trails because he agreed with me, and he very strongly agreed that I'd better do it quick because they were not, the trails were not there for long because the trails were put in, built by, and maintained by the cattle, the sheepmen before, and then the cattlemen. And they were still being used, everything from about, well, west of the national park at that time, which was over at Deer Creek, Thunder River area. Everything west of that was still had active grazing permits. Well, the cattlemen still put their cattle in and took them out, and all by horseback, pack animals, and they were the ones that maintained the trails, and their relatives and ancestors had built the trails. And if you, and his point he made to me was literally, you know, we can figure out how you can get from here to there, but you better do it this next few years because those trails aren't going to be here anymore when the grazing permits, when the permittee died, it reverted to a park, to the Grand Canyon National Monument. And it was obvious that that was going to be happening pretty regularly. So he, you know, was committed to the park, the National Monument, and the concept of it, and committed to a peaceful transition of the permittees. It was going to be a hardship on them, but in reality, it wasn't. Well, I learned from him that it wasn't that big a deal because a small portion of these cattlemen's herds were actually down in the canyon. But they definitely, if they had a permit with, you know, a dozen cows, they had an obligation to them, all their relatives and former ancestors, to actually have those dozen cows down in the canyon eating that grass. That was, you know, they were using it, but it was not, people were not going to go out of business because they couldn't move their cattle down in there.
Right.
A thing to remember is that on the Arizona Strip, that whole area there, it averaged 2 cows per section, which is square mile. And that was 2 cows and whatever calves they had. So to have 10 cows and were 5 square miles, and it was divided up. You know, most of the guys I knew out there had, oh, probably 40 or 50 head, which for a cattle operation is pretty small, but that's what they had, and they loved maintaining that. They all had other jobs in town, but they loved it. And when you've got millions, well, you've got, I don't know how many thousand square miles there are up there on the Arizona Strip, it adds up in the end to where there's a lot of cattle out there.
Right.
But
I'm going to go off on a little tangent here for just a minute. And I just remember Al Craig trying to run cattle there on the Craig place, and he really struggled for lack of water. And a lot of this strip doesn't have water, but once you drop into the canyon country, oftentimes there'll be springs.
Yeah.
And he basically noted that the survival of his ranch was reliant on the springs on his grazing allotment that he'd bought from someone else to get into 150 mile canyon.
Right.
So where there was water on the Esplanade down there, the rock unit above the red wall limestone, it was a big deal.
It was.
Because water was there. I mean, if it was no water, it wasn't a big deal because it was just as hard scrabble as any place else and nobody cared. But, man, when there was water there, it was a big deal.
Right. And they've wintered their cattle down in the canyon when they had a permit. And they had other permits up on top, like Al Craig, his property and his permits up on the tops there. I don't know how far it was. Was it 20 miles to the rim where you went off to 151 Canyon?
Or farther. It was a long way. You're exactly
Could have
right.
Been further than that, even. And they, you know, moved the cattle back and forth. In the summer, there was the monsoon season. The grass was good at the end of the summer up on the top, and then they moved them down into the canyon and were, again, not dealing with vast herds of cattle. I think Al Craig, in the end, he might have had 40 head, but I doubt it.
Right.
And
can you speak a little bit to the different missions, if you will? I don't know quite other word to use. The Park Service has a non-impairment mandate, and we think of tourism as the economy that is supported by that non-impairment mandate.
Is that term again?
The non-impairment mandate of the Organic Act, in such manner and by such means as will leave them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. And
right.
That basically excludes grazing.
Exactly.
And so now we have a little trouble between the sheep herders and the cattlemen and the Park Service, between the grazers and the agency trying to preserve the land in some sort of ecological integrity, as difficult
right.
as that is today, and fight off hordes of tourists who damage the ecological integrity of the land.
Yes.
So there's a definite tussle there. And I think your thoughts on that would be helpful.
Right. See, that's what Riffy was dealing with and what I was dealing with because I was definitely on the park side.
Right.
You know, and the idea of the wilderness and the idea of restoring and protecting and, the cattle just couldn't be there, and there's still so many battles going on in southern Utah and other places further west on the Grand Canyon over in the Shivowitz Plateau.
Right.
They're going through those things right now. And to me, fortunately, the Park Service or the politicians or whoever didn't come in and just kick the cattlemen off and with eminent domain or whatever. They actually, determined that the oldest permit or the youngest one in permit holder could have it for the rest of their life. And the cattlemen out there really couldn't complain about that. If they had to lose their grazing, that was closer to fair than anything else.
Right, a lifetime lease versus pack up and go.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
And how did John Riffy deal with that as the representative of the Park Service? I got to thinking of something. If you didn't know Riffy worked for the Park Service, you probably wouldn't. because he didn't wear a flat hat. He didn't wear the green pants and the gray shirt with the
right.
with the name badge. He wore a plaid shirt and jeans.
Yep.
And
exactly. And I would ask him, and he'd tell me, you know, and especially where I was planning a hike, he'd tell me who the permittee owners were, what their reputation was.
Okay.
You know, what, and about the only thing he would deter me from going into an area is if he thought when I came out of the hike my four tires would be flat, and that happened to me. Eventually, that was up in Colorado City, but that's a whole different bag up there. Anyway, he was, I could really sense the how the whole thing depended on Riffy's personality.
Wow.
He was everybody's friend. He was just his close friend to all the cattlemen. And, you know, they did not resent him because he wasn't the one
right.
closing the grazing down. It was the so-and-sos in Washington. And, you know, the other side to it I found was the cattlemen out there, and I mentioned, you know, the ancestors building the trails and all, they were very proud of the canyon. They respected it in their own way, and they, you know, they were very upset if someone was going to come in and put in a huge strip mine or something to tear up their country.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that here was a group coming in and saying, we're going to preserve the canyon. None of them had a complaint about with that. It was just that these the park really demanded no cows. And I'll have to admit, I'll just mention it now, but it might come up later, that I really transferred my hiking from, well, hiking on foot and going on horseback. And I explored most of the Western Canyon there with a horse and a pack mule and all my camera gear. And in the end, you know, deciding that even my outfit didn't belong there, even though I was pretty careful and had a minimal impact, especially by the cows that were around there. But John Riffy was just his personality and his persistence. And like you say, he didn't come barging up in a big patrol car or four-wheel drive with lights on top and a badge and a gun on his hip. He just came up to the cattlemen, and I was with him a lot of times. We'd see some guys out working cows, and he'd drive over, and we'd go and just talk to him. And he, you know, if he had driven by without stopping and talking, that would have been very concerning. Everyone would have been really upset, like, what's going on with John or today, or what did we do? And it he automatically talked to them. And and that's all I can say. It was just the force of his personality.
Yes.
I,
do you think that he kind of steered you to that job at Pipe Springs?
Well, he didn't directly, but the fact that I could see right away, you know, I came from California after the Army. I knew I was going to give the north rim, I call it, of the canyon a try. And right away, I meet Riffy, and I just all but the first day said, this is where I'm staying.
Just because he was so welcoming.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, and yeah, and I could see that this was basically unexplored country to the nation.
Okay.
The Sierra Club, to the environmentalists, and the people who were making the decisions, all of that. No one had really been out there, you know, other than the cowboys and the sheep herders and the river runners. But this was my kind of country, and especially since there were trails to be found.
Yep.
You know, to just go to the rim and look off the canyon and look off the cliff, you're kind of saying, well, I'm here and I'm never going to go there. But to find out that, yeah, you can go there. And that's why I stayed out there. And before I forget this, it's appropriate right here to talk about Pogo, my friend Pogo. Oh, and that's John's airplane. And it was a old Piper Cub. I mean, it was old for him. It was his personal plane. He had, with permission, bladed an airstrip just north of the monument boundary. So from his home and ranger station there, he could look probably 2 miles away. There was nothing in between, and could see the airport, and he built kind of a lean-to affair that he put the plane in and tied it down, and had a name for that too. I've forgotten. It was Tuip International Airport or something.
Right.
And right away, one of the third or fourth trips I was down there, and we were poring over the maps, and there was only these old USGS maps that referenced John Wesley Powell's survey that I always enjoyed. They had been surveyed more in the recently, but they based the survey on John Wesley Powell's. But these maps, and he finds, the only way I can describe what's going on up in this so-and-so canyon, where the trail is, let's go get in Pogo. And so we went down, and it was, you know, the first of many. I'm trying to think. I at least took 6 flights with him, maybe 8. It was just a great joy. And the plane was tiny. It was technically a 2-seater, but when they were flying, I was sitting behind him on a little seat with my legs wrapped around his waist.
Okay.
You know, around his seat.
Right.
So there was no space between the 2 seats. And, you know, it was all, you could see everything. It was a great thing to fly in that plane. The part that kind of distressed me was it was made of wood. The struts and everything was wood, covered with canvas.
Oh, wow.
So this was basically a kite with an engine on the front.
Yeah.
And it was, but it worked. And he was an outstanding, excellent pilot, knew the land, knew the plane, knew when to go, when to be safe. Never saw him do anything risky with it. And we'd go anywhere east or west that I was talking about exploring and fly just above the treetops on the Esplanade and check out trails. Then we'd go up the head of a canyon, like the SP, which is 151. And he would just fly around and around talking about, and we were below the upper rim on the top of the Esplanade, and I could see, there's the trail. And coming back along the Esplanade, I think you've hiked it, but the only real trail construction was whenever the trail crossed a wash.
Right.
Or one of these, and there'd be an amphitheater back in there, and you'd in effect have to walk a mile or two to cross and then walk out again and continue along the Esplanade. And where there were actual canyon, there was often trail built. And when you got back up on the Esplanade, you were basically on your own to know where the next one was. And so we checked out all of those, and I found that, they were all passable. The thing that happened, it was common, really, it turned out, that between Kanab Canyon and kind of Whitmore or Parashant, there were probably 10 grazing permits. But I was surprised how many old bulls were just stayed in there all year.
Oh, wow.
And most of those, I'd say half those permits had a single bull, who I think was just too ornery to get up out of the canyon when the other cows went. And they would just leave him there to, live out his life in peace.
Mm-hmm.
Because no one dared really force him out of the canyon.
Right.
To go up the switchback up a really rough trail. So those bulls were really important in keeping the trails open.
Oh, okay.
And I found out as I went along it myself, each of those things, there was definite tracks of big animals. I mean, because that was, if you wanted to be on the Esplanade on this side of a canyon and get to the other side, you had to go up to where the trail went and continue. So they were doing a service for me.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that is indelibly in my memory is we were flying. We went down over the Colorado, and we were down below the Esplanade and above the top of the Red Wall, kind of cruising along the side of the canyon there. And he was talking about there was a route to a mine there, which I was interested in. And a Air Force jet from Nellis Air Force Base flew right under us in the middle of the canyon. And to this day, I can vividly picture, I saw the pilot, his helmet and his face, and he was looking upstream, had no idea we would be down in there.
Right.
And my second thought was, they fly in pairs. Sure enough, over us went the second one. The
wow.
First one, he was down, I would say a lot less than 50 yards away. the roar of the engines and that the plane flew around. And it was the only time I saw Tom Griffey rattled. And he wasn't rattled, really. He just kind of said, I think we better go back to the airport for a while. Back to 2 weeks. Even though we had survived it, he was not happy about that. And I'm sure he sent a message to headquarters and to the South Rim, but that was a thing that I almost became used to, was probably every day that I was hiking near the inner gorge down at the bottom or halfway up on the red wall or something, jets from Nellis would fly up the canyon over below me, below the red wall.
Wow.
And the part that I really disliked was that, okay, they were going slow, and they were, they weren't supposed to be there. It was against their orders. But there's a lot of places where you look along the canyon, and especially out in the western side, where you can see 5 miles to where the canyon makes a right turn or a left turn. And I'd watch these planes getting smaller and watch them and wait and wait and wait. And at what seemed to me hiking at the absolute last second, they would flip on their side and zip around the corner of the canyon up there, scaring me to death. I hated that part. And in a couple years later, I felt good. Well, it was just where the wallaby, where the Bat Guano mine was.
Yes.
Above Wallapai on the north side. And they had a cable car system that hauled the ore, or the guano. It wasn't ore, it was guano. Big, huge buckets of it down this tramway across it. Crossed above the river. It was pretty high, maybe 100, 200 feet up. Well, it would have been more than that to make the story work, but probably 200 feet. And then the south rim there in the Wallapai Reservation was quite a bit lower than the north where the guano mine was. So they didn't need any machinery, I think, or minimal, to run this cable system, because just the weight of the car buckets brought it down and up the other side, and they would dump it out and haul it off. What I did hear later, and everyone in the Arizona Strip talked about it, was two jets were flying down the canyon just over the river heading back to Nellis, and the first one, suddenly he lost his control. He said, my steering is really weird. Have you had a problem? And the guy behind him says, well, I can understand, because you don't have a tail on your jet anymore. And he had put the cable and actually dumped the whole thing in the Colorado River. And he made it back to Nellis and landed, fortunately. The story on the Arizona Strip that I've never really verified, but that he was the commander that had issued the order not to fly in the canyon.
Ah.
And got his just desserts because he destroyed his plane. But fortunately, for all concerned, he got back to, and they all, someone hauled all that stuff out of there. I think the cables still can be seen.
Yeah, I'm going to just jump in here and note that the Batgoano mine is maybe 300 feet above the Colorado River on the north side. There was
right.
a large tower there just below the opening of the mine, a big vacuum by the Eureka Vacuum Company that would actually suck the guano up in the mine and put it into a big hopper and drop it into this Bat Guano car, and then winch
yeah.
it up 4,000 feet, I want to say, to the rim on the south side where the winch house was. There was a
okay.
Tower number one, a freestanding tower all by itself up on one of the promontories. No, it wasn't 4,000 feet because there is no,
yeah.
Just to the top of the red wall
yeah.
There. A few thousand feet. And so that cable was the longest free span cable of its time in the world by U.S. Steel, put that in there. And the military hit that thing. And the story I heard was that the lawyers for the guano company, which was now almost gone bust because the nitrate concentration, the nitrogen concentration in the guano, the deeper they pulled out the guano, the less nitrogen it had. The lawyers raced the plane to the Air Force base to sue, and they came to a settlement, which was they would drop all the cables and not restring them and get a payout and call it good.
Yeah.
Anyway, those odd stories, but I hadn't heard about the guy that hit the guy that hit the cable flying the plane was the one who'd given the orders to say don't fly in the canyon.
Well, and I don't have anything that to confirm that, but that was definitely the rumor that went around because back in the 60s on the Arizona Strip, everybody knew what everyone was doing and where they were and what they were doing. And, you know, rumor went fast, stories went fast. Back and forth, and it was that was cool. And you know, I was just considered myself lucky that Riffy took me up, and we had great times.
Nice.
Oftentimes, he was just going up to that. His job was to check on these cattlemen, and if he heard some of them were sneaking cows in somewhere they shouldn't, he often would use that as an excuse to fly because it was fun. And so he'd ask me to go along and we'd go and look for cows.
Nice.
Oh, and before I leave this, I got one more story that I've told for how many years, 40, 50, 60, 50 years at least. When I was on my trip from the Big Canyon, I'll get messed up, starts with a T.
Tuckup?
West, yeah, Tuckup. Tuckup, not Tuweep, not Toroweep, Tuckup. And I went down, I had a horse and a mule and went down off the main trail off the head of Tuckup and went around and was going to spend a couple days and did spend four or five days getting to Tuweep. That's where I was going to come out.
Okay.
And I was out on the Esplanade probably the second day and here comes Riffy. I could tell he was the only one with a plane that small coming right over the pinion trees and right at me, and I waved. I was on the horse, and I waved away, and he flew right over me and kept going. And I said, well, okay, maybe he's busy. He's not coming to see me. But he went up and did a couple circles in Tuckup and then flew back along the route that I was going to be doing. I thought that was strange. And then the third day, the next day, I was riding along, and here he comes again. And this time, he definitely changed course to come right at me, and he flips his wings back and forth. He flew around and around me, you know, waving out the window, and I waved back, and I did a thumbs up that everything was fine, and he could see I was on the horse, and the mule was packed and was on the right trail. And after I got out, I asked him, you know, why did you come up? Why didn't you see me the first time? That it looked like you did fly right over me. And he said, yeah, I was looking for you, but I couldn't see you anywhere. And the second time he flew up, he said, yeah, I saw you 2 miles away. Why? Well, because you had your white T-shirt on.
Oh, wow.
The day before, I had a green wool shirt on and sitting on the brown horse and the black mule and the pack, he flew right over me without seeing me, and I was, you know, not under the trees in the forest. I was just right there.
Yeah.
Waving at him. And that was a very important thing to me that I've tried to tell everyone who is out in the canyon or it fits anywhere, that, you know, if you're in a situation where you want to be rescued or seen from the air, get a white something. Because it was obvious that,
yeah,
when I, you know, saw later and saw other people, I could see, you know, hikers 2 miles away out there if they were just had a white T-shirt on. But otherwise, you can go through that country and not be seen at all. But that's just something that I've tried to tell everybody. If you have to be rescued, make yourself obvious.
Right, right. I'm curious, Alan. You're horse packing in northwestern Grand Canyon. What years was that, roughly? Was that in the late 60s?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Several things kind of went on at the same time, and it's kind of hard to me to really put a date on it. There was, in the fall of probably 67 or 68 at the latest, the cowboys from Moccasin were taking one of the guys, and it was Orville Palmer, P-A-L-M-E-R, and he lived up at Alton, Utah, but he was related to all the Moccasin Heatons, and he had his mother's permit down in Scotty's Canyon in Kanab Creek. And
okay.
He was taking his cattle down for the winter, maybe 10 or 15. And his cousins, and they asked me to go along. I probably asked if there was a possibility I could, and they I don't remember if I bugged them or they just like them to invite me along. And so I borrowed one of the horses and saddle and had my gear. I did not take the 8x10. I had my old 35mm single lens reflex, big deal. And I, we went down Kanab Canyon, went in Pack Canyon up on top of the rim down. There was a horse trail almost to the junction of Kanab Creek and Hack Canyon. And we went down and didn't go immediately up on the Esplanade. We went down the creek a ways, so it was maybe 200 feet down, and there was a canyon, no name to me, that you could go up. And then we rode around on the Esplanade, driving this head of this group of cows. And I know that when we finally got to the point or the watershed between Scotty's Canyon and the one to the north, there was a ridge there, and the trail went through this little saddle, and Orville or his relatives had built quite a barrier across there of rocks and cedar logs and pinyon pine logs and a gate of sorts.
Okay.
That was put together with, you know, out of the what they gathered up on the plateau there. And we ran the cows through there and, of course, closed the gate. Gate was open when we got there because they had brought the cows out in the spring.
Right.
And so now we closed that up, went in there and camped up there while Orville. There was a spring up in what I'd call the open basin there of Scotty's. There was another spring down just in the where it started into the supply. It was maybe the canyon down in there was maybe 40 feet deep, but that's where they camped. So there was a nice spring place to control the horses. We didn't want our horses to run away and get too ambitious. And then Orville went around and would kind of dig out the spring up in the basin and make sure the gate on the other side of his allotment was closed. And I hiked up and down Scotty's Canyon a little, and later years hiked from Kanab Creek up Scotty's to that. And they showed me where Orville had a trail off the rim, the highest rim, down into the Scotty's Canyon, the upper bay amphitheater, I'd call it.
From the east? From the highlands to the east?
From the north.
From the north.
If you think of Kanab Canyon running south,
yep.
Hack Canyon running east into
yes.
Hack, this was, I guess technically the trail was on the northwest side there. It was just near the head of the canyon, I know.
Okay, this is the stock trail that goes from the rim. This was the stock trail you first went down.
No, I had never been down there.
Oh, different, okay.
But he described it, and I could pick it out when I saw it, and that's the way Orville went in the winter. He'd go in once a month and just check the cows.
Yep.
Or just for the fun of it, or just to have an outing or whatever. But he'd oftentimes just drive out in his truck and run down the trail and check him out and then go back, or sometimes he'd take the horse down. Rarely did he camp in there, but that was typical of the way those allotments were used. And at the base of the talus coming off the rim, there was a lot of grass growing. I have to admit that those few cows, they did fine over the winter.
Hmm. What was Orville like? Was he short? Was he tall?
He's pretty tall.
Okay.
And he became really our best of friends in later years. And he worked for me as a wrangler on pack trips that I led.
Okay.
Many times. And he was and still is a character, a Southern Utah character. Everybody knows Orville.
Uh-huh.
And he's really a nice, nice guy. Very nice, very intelligent. He's a very old school cattleman, cowboy.
Okay.
But he got a degree in agriculture from Utah State. So he can't fake it too much. I don't know if I think his sons probably and daughter-in-laws probably have his cows up around Alton. They don't go down in Kanab Creek anymore.
Okay, all right.
On it, but that's the way I got started. And
I want to back up, Al, just a little bit. Did you ride horses as a kid?
Yes and no. I grew up in Los Altos Hills where we had 6 acres, and it was a pasture. It was on a steep hill.
Okay.
But it was grassland. It had been pastured to my grandfather's farm. And my uncle, I don't remember where in the world this burrow came up, but he asked if he could just graze it there, turn it out for a happy retirement. And I know I had to water it and check it, and I found it was very affectionate, and I could jump on the back and ride it, you know, all the time. So I didn't have any fear of animals, but I just learned quick. And the guys, I was positive and done things. We'd all laugh it off when I didn't do it again, you know. And it was, that was the start.
Okay.
I will mention one thing, since the whole goal was to go taking pictures, and I got some good pictures at the start of that trip, but I had bought it was an old war surplus ammunition carrier, and it had 2 straps on it, and I would strap that on my right leg, and you could open the top and put my camera fit in there perfectly. And I, would ride along, and I could just flip the lid, take out the camera and take pictures. Because once you turn the cows and the horses loose, you don't stop to put up a tripod or anything. They know where they're going, and they're heading at a good trot. But anyway, partway down there, and that's part of the story, I should have said. They were jogging along at a good pace, which was the one pace that I really disliked, because to me it was bone jarring.
Mm.
Bang, 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 bang. I could have a low gallop easy and a fast walk easy, but there was a certain pace that horses loved, that just were spine jarring to me. But the one time I was down there on that trip and reached down in my ammo case to bring it out, and I just brought the part of the case of the back case of the camera.
Oops.
The lens wasn't there. I looked down in the box, and the lens was somehow had jarred apart to where it was all just glass lenses and rings and
oh my.
Tubes, and I just had, you know, my camera was now in two pans full of junk.
Oh, no.
And I just laughed, and I still laugh about it because it was the last thing I thought would happen.
Yeah.
When I got a new camera and a better one, I still used that thing, but I lined it with foam rubber and made a case that I now knew what I would subject it to, but that was a learning experience.
That's a neat idea, putting a little box on your leg there to hold your camera.
Right, and it was perfect. It was out of the way, but it was right, you know, in a backpack, you basically have to take it off.
Yeah, yeah.
To get the camera, so that worked, and I learned there, and soon after that, I was able to, you know, describe the trip I wanted to do down tuck up and around the two weep, and the friends there in Moccasin were supportive, and I borrowed a horse, and I borrowed a mule, and packing gear, and saddle, and my friend Mel Eaton, he drove me out in the stock in just his pickup that had a stock rack on it, and
hey Alan,
good luck.
I'd love to hear more about that trip. And
yeah.
We've been going for over an hour now. Maybe maybe this is a good place to pause this interview series, and we'll pick this back up with your horsepacking trip.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
And yeah, you can stop and then I'll make a couple things.
Yeah. Is there anything else you want to add to the material we just covered?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
Good start.
I'll always ask. And then with that, this will conclude part 7 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is Thursday, October 20th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very much.
Thank you. This was fun.